If you'll open them up to Ruth tonight. We've been going through on Wednesday nights, we've gone through Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus, Numbers and Deuteronomy and Joshua and the Judges and all of these amazing books that have told how God delivered, well, how God established the nation of Israel, how they were in captivity, how God brought them out of captivity, established them in their land, their difficult times through the dark ages. And you know, a lot of the characters that we've looked at as we've looked at the Bible stories here have been larger than life. I mean, you know, you think about Moses and the burning bush and the parting of the Red Sea, and you think about Joshua and all the conquests and the making the walls of Jericho fall down. You think about Gideon with a handful of guys delivering Israel. And, you know, these events just seem larger than life in a lot of ways. You look at that and it just seems like, boy, our lives could never measure up to that kind of stuff. As hard as we try to paint these characters in a realistic light, there still can be a tendency to look at these things and you know, just and look at how incredible, you know, and impressive these lives are, and start to contrast that with our own lives and think, well, you know, my life isn't all that impressive. There's nothing that dynamic or amazing about what goes on in my life. And we have a tendency sometimes to look at the biblical narrative and read it like an outsider. Look at it like, you know, well, that was about those guys, and they were big, and they were spiritual, and they were amazing. But me, you know, what am I? I'm not that impressive. I'm not that amazing. And we read the scriptures sometimes as outsiders, as observers, instead of participants, which is what God has called us into. This is an amazing story that we, sitting here tonight, are a part of. This is what God's called us into. And even the stories like we hear tonight are part of that story as it unfolds. And so, you know, we can look at it and think, well, I'm not all that impressive. There's not that much amazing going on in my life. Or, you know, I haven't seen a burning bush or a wall fall down or anything like that. And then we turn the page and we come to the book of Ruth, which is this little short story in the middle of the biblical narrative that tells a story about some, well, a couple widows and a farmer in some backwoods town in Palestine. Not really what you would call the stuff of glamour or bigness at all. And here we see how God just takes what would seemingly be an inconsequential outsider to everything else and weaves his story not only around her but through her. And the story of, you know, of God's big plan for humanity is told out in allegory, the story of redemption, even down to the lineage of Christ, David and then Christ, all comes through Ruth. This is what God provides. And what we see is how God folds Ruth into the big story that he's unfolding here. Even these inconsequential, what would seem like inconsequential, even maybe uninteresting lives, God uses and brings them up to the forefront. And what it does then is it eliminates all of our excuses for thinking that our lives are too unimportant or too unimportant to God, because in God it's all important and it's all part of this grand story that he's unfolding. And that's what we see in Ruth. Now, Ruth is set in the time of the judges. We'll see that as we're going through it. It's all before the monarchy. The story takes place before the monarchy of Israel is established, though we know it's written based on the way he's referring to it, the writer is referring to it, it's written during the time of the monarchy, because it's kind of a look into the past. It's a period piece here in the Bible. The author of Ruth is unknown. The Jewish rabbinical tradition of the Talmud says that Samuel wrote the book of Ruth, and that, of course, has been an established thing among their traditions for a long time. Many scholars hold to that and believe that that's true, though if Samuel did write it, some editorializing had to have been done in it, because at the end of it, there's a genealogy that gives special significance to David. David, of course, is a king that comes after Samuel, so someone would have had to editorialize it, change it or add on the genealogy at the end of the book, if it were true. But there's, you know, by and large, it's all conjecture. We don't know. The author of the book of Ruth isn't identified at all. There's actually some very intriguing, provocative suggestions by some scholars that Ruth was written by a woman, some unnamed woman. And the reason that they believe that, which I think has some very interesting support for it, is that The whole perspective is different from any of the books that you're going to look at in the Bible, in that it comes entirely from the feminine perspective. We're looking at the whole story from Ruth's point of view, or from the woman's point of view, which is, it's an odd thing. It's an unusual thing. If Samuel did write it, he was definitely in touch with his feminine side. So, but we really don't know who wrote it, and it really doesn't matter who wrote it. Ruth used to be included with the book of Judges. When we were studying Judges, we would have continued right on into Ruth, but it was later divided into its own category, into a story all of its own. The names in the book are very curious. Most of them carry a meaning that are integral to the story, and we'll look at those as we go along. But if it weren't for the genealogy at the end, you could almost look at this and say this was allegory. The characters' names are so important to the actual story itself, in how it's unfolding, that, you know, some have suggested that it was allegory, and that the I don't know what that was. I'm falling apart apparently, but some have suggested that it was allegory, and the historical genealogy is to be dismissed. But I disagree. To me, that's what's so cool about this story that God gave us, is that it can be and is allegorical, as we'll see as we get into it, and historical at the same time. That's the bigness of God weaving his story through all of these things and trying to communicate this message to us. Remember, God isn't trying to get us to a place where we've got a lot of information about him. He's actually very stingy with his information about himself. What he's trying to do is get our attention all the way through it. There's a continuous message that comes to the Word of God that is saying, I'm here, I'm here. You haven't paid attention to me. You've forgotten who I am, but I'm here, and I love you, and I have a plan for you. And that comes through in this book as well. Well, the next question that we ask about Ruth is why? I mean, why is it here? What's it telling us? There are several themes that run through the book of Ruth, but the two main themes that we're going to find in this book deal with redemption and deal with loving kindness. That is the purchase back of something, the redeeming of something, the taking something that is worthless or ruined and making it good again and right again, and loving kindness being demonstrated by a benevolent savior type. There's an emptying and a filling theme that runs through it, and we'll see that it follows suit with the cycles of life, because most of us know what it's like to go through an emptying. A lot of us go through emptyings all the time, emptyings that take place only so that God can refill the way that he wants it filled. And so that's what we see demonstrated in this story as well. So for the Old Testament Israelite, you know, the comfort that's derived from a concept like that, of a redemption, of, you know, that's a universal theme in and of itself for redemption, but also the emptying and filling. When you consider Israel's history and the difficulties of her history, you could see why the Israelite would hold this book in a special place and observe it that way. But for us who read it through the lens of the New Testament, it takes on an entirely new meaning. A meaning that's grand in its scope and magnificent in its consequence in our own life. And we're going to see in this a type and a metaphor of Christ and his work, the hero's rescue of us who were outsiders, and how he brought us who were empty to this state of fullness in him. So without further ado, we're going to jump into the book of Ruth here. I say jump in. I've been talking for half an hour. Have I been talking for half an hour? Okay. Oh, that's right. Yeah, okay. Whew. I was thinking, I feel worse than I thought. I passed out and didn't even know it and kept on talking. All right, Ruth chapter 1. Let's read these first five verses. These first five verses are known as the overture. And what they do is they set the stage for us of this story. Verse 1, now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Noami. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech Noemi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the woman survived her two sons and her husband. Now, this is a great story. And to me, the message is magnificent when it comes to this. I just want to read these first 5 verses over again to you. And I want to read them out of the message because I love the way Eugene Peterson does this. Chapter 1, verse 1. Once upon a time. It was back in the days when the judges led Israel. There was a famine in the land. A man from Bethlehem in Judah left home to live in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The man's name was Elimelech. His wife's name was Noemi. His sons were named Malchon and Chilion, all Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah, and they all went to the country of Moab and settled there. Elimelech died, and Noemi was left. She and her two sons. The sons took Moabite wives. The name of the first was Orpah, the second Ruth. They lived there in Moab for the next 10 years. But then the two brothers, Malchon and Chilion, died. Now the woman was left without either her young men or her husband. Whew, I love it. What a great introduction to a story. I mean, you know that Benjamin Franklin actually took this story and changed all the names in it and presented it to a literary group that he was associated with. And when he was done reading it, they all applauded it and said it was one of the finest short stories they'd heard, beautiful and romantic. And then he revealed that it actually came out of the Bible. It's magnificent stuff here. But in these first 5 verses, we see the description of the misery of Noemi. And we see this theme there of emptying and filling, being able to be unfolding before us. A famine has struck Israel. Now, this is something that God had promised would never happen unless they forsook him. So we know in the time of the judges, they had a rough go of it. They were back and forth on these things all the time. And it was a problem for them. So the first bit of irony that is introduced in this story is how it says that there was no famine, that is, there was no bread, and he was from Bethlehem, which means the house of bread. So there was no bread in the house of bread. So we've got this emptying theme going on right away. And so these Ephrathites, they pick up stakes and they move to Moab. And an interesting note that reinforces, again, this feminine perspective of this book is that the Old Testament men in the Bible are never identified in respect to their wives. In other words, you never find that kind of a phrase like we find here in verse 3 when it says, Elimelech, Noemi's husband, died. That's an unusual phraseology there in the context of the Old Testament. You don't normally find that. So again, we have this story here that is coming from the perspective of the woman who is suffering these things. Now the father's name means God is my king. So again, we've got this concept here, and it's even kind of almost a forecast to what is progeny will be through later on. But the son's name further reinforce how dire the circumstances are going to get, because Mahlon means sick and Chilion either means weak or heartsick or homesick. It's not absolutely clear as to what it means, but either way, none of them are real pleasant. Those aren't names that you would necessarily want to name your kids. Or maybe you would want to name your kids that. I don't know. That's kind of up to you. So Elimelech dies, and the two sons end up marrying these foreign ladies who are outsiders of Israel. And of course, right away, we're faced with this ethical conflict here, because all through the Old Testament up to this point, we're warned over and over and over again, you know, don't marry those who are outside of Israel. And I mean, so you've got a strange mix of things going on here. This idea that a famine's come, and here a man picks up stakes and he takes his family and he trudges off to Moab, a foreign country with foreign gods, and foreign ideals in an attempt to try to fix the situation, kind of typifying the way we go about trying to handle things on our own. Instead of trusting the Lord, we oftentimes find ourselves going to strange circumstances and things outside of God to find comfort or hope or help. And so in the process here, her sons end up marrying these foreign girls. And then after 10 years of being married to them and apparently having no children by them, those guys die. Well, one of them we know was even named Six, so I guess, you know, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy there. And remember, this is the overture. This is setting the scene for what this is all about. This is the stage that the acts are going to be played out on. And so we have Noemi. She's uprooted because of this famine. She's had to leave her home and all that she's known. She's here in a foreign land, a place that's completely, you know, cut off from her extended family. Her sons have married foreign women, and now they die. And so now it's three childless widows who are cut adrift in the world to try to fend for themselves. And I'll tell you, In the time that this is written, in the culture, and it even holds true to some degree to this day within Middle Eastern and Eastern societies, a widow ends up finding herself on the lowest rung of the societal ladder. She has no husband who's overseeing things for her. She has no husband who's providing for her, providing inheritance, all these different things. But a childless widow wasn't even on the ladder. I mean, that's how low it was for her. So the characters that are introduced to us here are in dire straits indeed. I mean, we're talking about the worst of the worst situation that could happen. These three childless women, now without husbands, now cut adrift. What are they going to do? I mean, this is dire misery piled up on misery for these people. It's easy to read over it and lose sight of the significance of the weight of this for these women. So what's next? What could possibly happen? Well, verse 6, "And she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread," talking about back up in Israel. "Therefore she went out from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah." So this is good. This is a great sign. You know, she's not content or willing to just stay there in this misery and give up and die and forget about it. Upon hearing that God was up to good things in the land of Israel, she gathers her daughters-in-law and says, "Let's go. We're gonna head on up there." Well, actually, it doesn't necessarily, you know, indicate that she gathered them, but they all set out together. She's taking off. We'll see how that kind of pans out. But you know, they pack up and they head back north. They pack up the truck and they take off and they're gonna find their way back. Verse 8. "Now, and Noemi said to her two daughters-in-law, 'Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me.'" In other words, with their husbands and her and their father-in-law. "The Lord grant you that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." So she kissed them and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "Surely we'll return with you to your people." But Noemi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go, for I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters. For it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." All right. So Naomi just, you know, apparently they've begun their journey, and at some point along the way here in the journey, she's saying, "Go home. You know, you guys shouldn't be doing this with me." Why is she doing this? Why is all of a sudden she turning to try to send these girls home? Why would she do this? Well, in one sense, we see that Noemi has become bitter because of her circumstances here. She's emphasizing her misery, and especially what she's saying here, and in summary, what she's saying at the end of it is, look, God is against me. God's hand is against me. My life is bitter, and if you keep hanging out with me, your life's going to end up bitter too, and that just is more than I want the responsibility for. So she's trying to say, my circumstances are so bad that I will drag you into my nightmare if you go with me, and so you need to go home. And, you know, there's a lesson in this for us, because sometimes when we've decided that that God's against us, that things are working so bad against us, that God just doesn't seem to care. We have this tendency to exaggerate our hopelessness. And she was here in this. She wasn't thinking through all the possibilities that were available in this. She's so focused in on the bitter circumstances that she's facing that they become monumental. They become her identity. And we'll see this a little bit later on. She does take this on as an identity. And we've got to be so careful about that as believers, as those who trust in the Lord, that we never get to this place where we are going to take on these hard situations, these hard circumstances, and take those on as though that's who we are now. That's just my life. This is my rotten luck. It always goes this way. I never have any hope. Nothing ever goes right for me. We begin to focus this way, we'll actually turn into that. That will be a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it's short-sighted, it's myopic in its scope, because it's not seeing the potential that exists out there. Obviously, Noemi, she doesn't know the future. Nobody knows the future. But she has no hope in the future, and that's the problem. You know, as long as we have breath, as long as we're standing here, as long as there's horizons out in front of us, we have hope in Christ. We always have hope in Christ. We don't ever want to fall into this kind of behavior like she falls into there. Did I just beep? Was that me? Okay. all kinds of odd noises are emanating from me. Well, that doesn't sound right either, but you know what I mean. Okay, so she sets the stage. She's setting the stage for what's going to come, and she emphasizes that there's no hope in these girls basically staying with the family name. You know, you don't need to try to stay with this family name because it's not going to help you at all. You know, she's evidently forgetting the law there in Deuteronomy, the levirate marriage law, which was instituted for just such a circumstance as these women are facing, as these two widows are facing, this, the widows of her sons, where a brother or a close relative could come in and inherit, take over, purchase the inheritance that would have normally come to them, and then take over the familial responsibilities and duties of a husband to these widows to protect them and to redeem the family name, to keep the family name going on. The sons that would be born would be carrying the name of the one who had passed away. That was the whole concept behind it, why God instituted so that families wouldn't die out this way. But Noemi is forgetting all of this. Or maybe she didn't. Well, we'll see that she did know it, so she's forgetting it somehow. The bitterness is too much for her to be able to look past. Okay, so then we get down here to verse 14. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, look, your sister-in-law has... Wait a minute, did I skip something? Okay. Your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. So here we see that, you know, the reaction to this is, you know, they're both heartbroken. Orpah kisses her mother-in-law, but it's more of a sense of, you know, kissing her goodbye, saying, okay, I see this. Obviously, she saw something in the logic of her argument there that she was willing to go along with. You know what? This makes sense. You are bad luck. I'm going home. And her name means the nape of the neck or the back. Some have translated it to mean gazelle, but more appropriately, it means the nape of the neck or the back of the neck, which suits what she does. She turns her back and she goes back home. She turns back. Whereas Ruth's name means friend. And in contrast, we see that Ruth is clinging. She hugged on to Noemi and she's not letting go. She's just holding there. And Noemi tries to urge her to go with her. Look, you know, your sister-in-law sees a sense of this. Go on home with her, but she's going to have nothing of it. And it sets this up, you know, what a you know, an interesting story we've got so far. It's getting dire, it's getting bad, it's emotional. We got this drama in it, and then we come upon this wonderful response from Ruth. Here in verse 16 it says, but Ruth said, entreat me not to leave you or turn back from following after you, for wherever you go, I'll go, and wherever you lodge, I'll lodge. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. When she saw that she was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. So she quits trying to argue with her when she hears this speech. Now, this is just an amazing thing for Ruth to say. Again, you know, we read it, and most of us are familiar with it. I'm sure we've heard it a million times in Bible stories and different contexts. But really, really, let it sink in what she is saying here. This is amazing. In the face of Noemi's grim description of her future with her, she already told her, look, I'm death to everybody. Everybody's dying around me. I got nothing to go back to. She paints this dark and bleak picture of the future. Ruth turns around and pleads with her to go with her. And the more you ponder it, the more amazing it becomes, because here Ruth is saying, I'm going to leave my family that I've known and leave the country that I'm familiar with. I'm going to go to a place that has that's unfamiliar, that has different customs, a different religion, a different language than what I've ever known. I'm going to follow you. I'm going to go with you. And I'm going to live this life of a childless widow with you as far as she knows, because there's no promise that she's aware of in Noemi's words to her. All she's heard is this dire prediction that it's all ruined for me. And yet, in the face of that, Ruth turns to her and says, let me go with you. Her commitment, her friendship with Noemi was so strong. Oh, I'll tell you, we could learn from that. All of us could learn from that in the relationships that we have. That's down to parents and children. That's down to husbands and wives. That's down to relationships within the church fellowship and those that we walk with, to have that kind of commitment to one another. I will be with you. And this is a commitment that she's making here, that she's looking to make this commitment as the ultimate outsider. She's going to be completely outside of anything that she knows in a comfortable sense. And then she says, your God will be my God. That's an amazing leap right there, because we don't have any kind of indication as to how she got to that point. Maybe her husband, you know, maybe the husbands of Noemi and Elimelech had talked to them about the God of Israel and told them about their faith, and there was something in that that sparked her interest. We don't know. There's nothing in the story that says that. All we know is that at this point, at this juncture, Ruth makes that commitment. I will follow you. Your God will be my God. I will follow him as well. And that's what she's saying to here. This is an amazing thing. You know, and she's doing this, according to verse 17, for life. This is a lifelong commitment. She even swears, if anything but death separate us in this, then I'm not faithful in what I've promised or decided to fulfill here. I tell you, in all of this, we can even see God's ideal for mankind. When you look at her, look at what she's committing to. Look what she's jumping at the chance for. I mean, there's nothing necessarily favorable in that. You know, we've got all these PR firms and marketing schemes about trying to make Christianity appealing to the world and pizzazzy and snazzy and cool, and it'll make you feel good. And yet, you know, we're missing something in the process of that. We've got a lot of people who are willing to walk away from Christ at a moment's notice because we're not getting the fuller picture of it. Jesus never promised us that everything was going to go great. It was going to be a beautiful, you know, sunset that we were walking into all the time. He promised, in this life, you're going to have tribulation. It'll be troublesome for you, but be of good cheer, because I overcame it. You can overcome. And what we see in this ideal for mankind is this desire to live by faith beyond what we see within a present circumstances. The present bitterness that's faced is simply an obstacle that is looked over, and a hope, and a bright hope for a future is present within the heart. And this courage to venture into something unknown, to take the hand of God in essence and follow him into an adventure like this, that's, you know, we see that over and over again. We saw that with Abraham. We saw that with Moses. We see it with the great characters, and we see it here with these small characters, where God is looking for that from us, that willingness to accept that challenge, to believe beyond what we see, and to follow and to trust whether we understand or know how it's all going to work out or not. Well, verse 19, now the two of them went until they came to Bethlehem. And it happened when they had come to Bethlehem that all the city was excited because of them. It was a small town, and Naomi had been known, obviously. And the women said, is this Naomi? But she said to them, don't call me Naomi. Naomi means graceful or full of grace. Call me Mara, which means bitterness, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. Remember what I said about how when we begin to define ourselves by the negative circumstances and the difficulties of our lives, how we take that identity on? And here she's done it. Now she is consumed by this. This is her whole identity, is the problems that she's had. This is just who I am. Don't call me graceful. No grace around here. Call me bitter. Okay, bitter. She says, I went out full. Here we come back to these themes of emptying and filling. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest, which will be very significant as we go on. But, they get home. People are glad to see her. Hooray! Naomi's home, and of course she rebukes them. I'm not graceful. I'm very bitter now. And her theology in this, well, actually I was going to make a different point, but you know what? Her theology in this is actually quite familiar. In fact, C.S. Lewis writes a whole book called A Grief Observed, where, when his wife Joy was taken from him, he felt as though his joy had been taken from him in all respects. And he said that it wasn't that he didn't believe that God existed, but he didn't believe that God was good, that he believed that God was cruel and vicious in the process. And so he chronicles, if you're going through hard times, if you're going through bitterness, it's a good book to read. I highly encourage you to read it. It starts out rough. It'll shake you up if you're willing to be shaken as you look at what he says. But boy, when it finally comes back around and it hits home who God really is in the process of this. But we're tempted to do that all the time. When circumstances are so bad and things are so dire, we're tempted to start looking at this as though, God's not on my side. Our theology gets a little bit twisted. We don't deny God exists. We don't deny that he's sovereign or that he controls the affairs of men, but we decide he's mean. He's not trying to help me. He's forgotten me. He doesn't care about me. And we forget. We don't see this in light of the hope that is resident there within God himself. We've got to remember the character of who this God is. We've got to remember not only the character of this God, but the character and the nature of the dire circumstances that we face. We've said it before, but it still ends up being true no matter how it pans out. Those negative circumstances, those bitter things that happen, are the soil in which God plants his great miracles that he works out in our lives. And the greatest miracle of all will be when we stand with him in that kingdom, palm branches in our hands, robes washed in blood, when we stand there and all the bitterness before is washed away, passed away, and we stand there with him in a new kingdom, in a new age, where we don't face the difficulties we face in this time. That's the hope we have in Christ. And when we become myopic in our understanding of things, when we become so narrowly focused on the bitterness of our present circumstances, we lose sight of and forget this God of all comfort, this God of grace, whose sole purpose through this whole story has been to rescue us by some means. Right? Okay, well, cool. Well, we'll stop there for now, and let's... I'll tell you what, and it kind of puts you on the spot. Anybody got any questions or comments or anything?
I was listening to John Corson, mm-hmm. and he was talking about honoring your father and mother.
Uh-huh.
But he said, he also said in-laws, as well, after he got a big groan from the audience, but he said that in